Hi everyone, it's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. You know, one of the biggest questions I get on the show is, what exactly goes into a business exit plan, and when should I start creating mine? Well, I always tell people that the best time to start was 5 years ago, but the next best time is now because you never know when you might need it. So we put together a free report that describes what an exit plan is and what you should know. You can get it free by texting EXIT PLAN with no spaces to 44222. That's EXIT PLAN to 44222. Again, text EXIT PLAN to 44222.
Welcome to the Exit Coach Radio Show, the show for baby boomer business owners who are looking for cutting-edge information as they plan their 3 to 10 year business succession and exit. Every week, we interview top professional advisors for their best tips, strategies, and precautions so you can be well-planned. And don't miss our one-minute Exit Coach tip of the day on ExitCoachRadio.com. And now, here's your host, the Exit Coach, Bill Black.
Hey everyone, thanks so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it. We have a great lineup of guests today, and we're going to jump right into it with our first guest. He is Daniel Sachs from Meerkat Restaurant Advisory in Chicago. And what Dan does, he's a hospitality consultant, but he's also a professor and entrepreneur in residence at DePaul University. And he's written a new book called The Million Dollar Greeting, and we're going to find out all about what that's all about. But first, let's get him on the line and get to know him a little bit. Daniel, thank you for joining me today. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. Looking forward to talking to you.
Well, same here. I've been looking over your overview sheet here, and looks like an interesting book that you've written. But, you know, I'm really curious, and I'm sure our listeners are too, about who you are and what you do as an entrepreneur in residence at DePaul University. I love that title. Tell us a little bit about you and your background.
Sure. Yeah, I started out very young. When my mom went back to work, I started out working cooking. And so a lot of my career was in the restaurant business. I started in the back of the house in the kitchen and ultimately made my way to the front of the house and owned restaurants in Chicago for many, many years until I got old and tired and decided that the better path was to become a teacher rather than an operator. So I made my exit and got out, and that worked out really well for me. And I have since sort of unexpectedly, but really with a lot of enjoyment, started teaching entrepreneurship at DePaul. And as luck would have it, and as the way things turn out, I'm now the entrepreneur in residence there at the Coleman Entrepreneurship Center, which is an incubator for students and graduates of DePaul and their business ideas. So it's part mentorship and part connecting budding entrepreneurs with potential funding, other mentors, local businesses in Chicago. It's a pretty vibrant community here, so a lot of exciting stuff going on.
That sounds really exciting. I love to hear that entrepreneurship is alive and well in universities, and that young people have experienced people they can learn from. And if you survive the restaurant industry, then you are truly a survivor.
Right? That's
that's one of the toughest
to
businesses. And that's great. It sounds like out of your experience, you've written a new book called The Million Dollar Greeting. Why write a book, and who are the leaders profile? Tell us a little bit about this book.
Yeah, that's great. I appreciate you bringing it up. I think both through my own work, and I work as a consultant in hospitality as well, and teaching at DePaul, one of the things that came up consistently, because the students I teach are in the business school and they're not necessarily hospitality students, is this understanding of how the term hospitality and how we relate to our customers and our employees and strategize around that, it sometimes gets lost in the muckety muck of day-to-day business. And so I really felt like one way to talk about that was to both try to articulate a vision for that and also profile CEOs at various size companies, everything from Hyatt Hotels, which has got over 100,000 employees, to this Nick's Pizza and Pub here in the suburbs of Chicago that's got three pizza joints. and look at how they successfully are able to integrate what I would say are traditional hospitality practices into their business model in a way that really is a tool that can be used by anybody in any business. And in fact, we even profile other companies that have nothing to do with hospitality as a way of showing how they may use different terms, but they use the same tools. There's a company up in Canada, of all places, called FreshBooks, which many of your listeners may be familiar with. They're the largest accounting software company for entrepreneurs and independent businesses and freelancers. And they integrate similar programs in their own business. And the guy who founded that, guy Mike McDermott, really mm-hmm. thoughtful leader in that respect.
What a fascinating experience that must have been. How long did it take you to compile all this information and do all the interviews and get it all together?
Yeah, it was. It's funny you say it was a fascinating experience. It took a good six to eight months to get a mm-hmm. hold of everybody, convince them that this was legitimate, that sharing
right.
the secrets was worthwhile, and mm-hmm. and the book really wrote itself and from a practical standpoint. But what was really exciting from my perspective was being able to talk to these folks and hear their stories and sort of what their inspiration was. And the themes ultimately in these nine very disparate businesses were common. And that was what fueled the fire of writing the book, is that these ideas around authenticity and community and culture in their company and establishing a vision and the way that they were consistent about implementing that those themes recurred with each story, manifested in different ways because the businesses were different, but at the end of the day, the themes were very, very similar.
Well, I've got a question for you, Dan, that maybe put you on the spot a little bit, but pretend I'm the CEO of Hyatt Hotels and you've just called me. What did you say to get them to agree? What was your vision statement that got them to go, I see where you're heading with this, and I'm on board? I think our listeners would like to know that.
Yeah, I think the key in those situations is doing your homework in advance. So I knew mm-hmm. that at Hyatt, for example, the CEO, Mark Hoplamazian, we had a common appreciation and understanding for what the role and the term, the actual term hospitality meant and how it related to building great culture. And in his case, he really believes that sort of his philosophy around empathy, actually, and empathy for your customer and your employee was a differentiator in the hotel business. And so I was able to talk to him in a context and with detail that resonated, and I think that makes a big difference. There's
yes.
I definitely didn't mm-hmm. I didn't hit bat 1,000%. I was maybe a middling 250 to 300 hitter when it came to this is the home of the Cubs here in Chicago, so
that'll make you a lot of money in the big leagues. Yeah.
But I definitely found that to the extent that I could do the research and it did foster really positive connections. And it helps knowing
a few people
in the business too, you know.
Yeah, and it doesn't hurt to say that you're the professor and entrepreneur in residence at a major university too. That's awesome. So when you're doing all this, I'm sure things rose to the top as common traits. What are the five key qualities that great leaders share that you've uncovered in your book?
Yeah, I think there are lots of different ways to start. And certainly understanding a corporate culture is critical, and being able to articulate your culture is important, and people talk about that a lot. I think one of the hardest parts to really think about in your daily business is understanding what accountability really means. Because
mm-hmm.
it's one thing to pay lip service to your vision or your business plan, but to be present in the moment and be able to be accountable to yourself, to your employees, and to your customers a week, 2 weeks, a month, 3 months, 6 months after you put a strategy in place. That's really a tough nut to crack, I think, for a lot of people, because as entrepreneurs, and I know this from my own experience, you know, you're putting out the fire that's right in front of you, and sometimes that's a good excuse not to be accountable in the way that you might theoretically want to be accountable. And one of the things I noticed with these leaders that I spoke to is that they put being accountable to themselves and their employees and their customers at the top of the food chain, so to speak, when it came to building their business. And in conjunction with accountability came being authentic, right? Being true to yourself. And that was equally important, along with building the kind of community both within your company and as your company is within the universe of its business, that fits. Again, being consistent, being accountable, mm-hmm. being authentic, mm-hmm. and then ultimately really establishing a vision for your business that you can live with. A lot of times I see companies and clients that I have, and I see this across the board, where there's a vision that's developed, it's framed nicely, stuck on a wall, and then forgotten about. And I think one of the things that came up in this book was that the leaders that I talked to really were drinking their own Kool-Aid when it came to following through on their vision on a daily basis. And so all these ideas really ultimately were interwoven, whether they were vision or culture, or community, or accountability, authenticity. Those five values really work in conjunction with each other, not as individual ideals.
So I heard accountability and being authentic and having a vision. Did I miss the other two? I might have.
The other two are community and culture. So a great organization to think about in that context is Brooklyn Brewery, which is another company that's profiled, and Steve Hindy, who's the founder and CEO there. So Brooklyn Brewery started almost 30 years ago now, out of Brooklyn, New York. And in the beginning, it was one of the first, if not the first, microbreweries, craft breweries in the country. And what Steve identified was that staying true to the culture of Brooklyn and the culture of the craft beer movement was critical to the brand's long-term success. So even though now Brooklyn Brewery is the largest independent brewery around the world, actually they export all over the world, they are still true to that value. And Steve is still engaged with his employees. He tells the story of his brewmasters coming up with a new beer and him having them, all the brewmasters for the brewery, over to his house for a picnic to try the new beer and this, that, and the other. And then he says, you know, and the crazy thing is that then the word got out that I had a picnic for the brewmaster. So the next thing you know, I got the accounting department over at my house for a picnic, and I got, you know, and,
right.
And he's really living that culture, that sense of community, even though he doesn't need to do that anymore. You know, he could just sit back and sip on some good beer and rest on his laurels, but he's still engaged in building that kind of culture in a way that I think his employees feel like he's engaged in true hospitality. And as a result, then that feeling ultimately manifests itself in the way that they work with their customers, right? We're all part of the service economy these days. And so understanding mm-hmm. the interdependence really has benefited a company like Brooklyn Brewery, for example, over the long haul.
I love that because I think we're all sick and tired of the companies that are they're connected until they aren't, you know, until they grow to a certain size. And I've been through that myself, where I worked for a company that was very familial, big company, but all of a sudden they went public and there was another master to serve and the whole culture and feel of the company changed and they lost that connection with a lot of people. Even though they said they were still willing to have it. It just didn't feel the same. So that's refreshing to hear that companies would focus on. So I heard accountability, the authenticity, having that vision that you can really rely on and count on, and that really fits you, community and culture. Those are five really big attributes. So I think you're really onto something. Let's talk about the title, The Million Dollar Greeting. That's intriguing. What is the Million Dollar Greeting?
Well, I think the snappy title. The idea is really to drive home the point that these kinds of what might be termed as soft values,
mm-hmm.
they're not really immediately translatable to the bottom line, do in fact have bottom line financial benefits, because
mm-hmm.
whether it's through employee retainment, whether it's through citizenship behaviors by your employees or recruitment, and certainly those kinds of things are really valuable with the millennial generation in the workforce
mm-hmm.
these days and the transients that we see across the board. So, it's not an obvious we're saving a nickel on this widget kind of benefit, but certainly incorporating these values does have long-term financial success, and these companies are examples of organizations that have been able to demonstrate that over time. And I think that's a key, is it's not just a drop in the bucket today, but it's something that is worth investing in and will reap benefits over the long haul.
Makes a lot of sense what you're saying, and I hear a lot of content about millennials in the workforce these days, and exactly what you're saying, the culture, the community, having that vision that everybody gets it, and remaining accountable to that. It makes a lot of sense what you're saying. It sounds like an awesome book. Who do you want to read this book and why?
Everybody who's got $24.95 and access to Amazon.
Uh-huh.
No, I think in the end, the book does have value for a lot of people in business, whether you're a senior leader at a company or just starting out, because it tries to, through these real world examples, paint a picture of how good companies behave and what leaders do in these good companies to be successful. So whether you are looking to find a company that has the kind of values that you share, or if you are an existing leader who is looking for a way to differentiate your business by adding some of these values into your daily practices, I think there's a lot of real meat there. For those
mm-hmm.
kinds of folks, I make my students buy it too. But
I was going to say, you got a built-in
that's
audience,
really not,
don't you?
Not probably the core audience.
Well, no. Next question: If you're getting young folks to buy it, how many pages is it?
Oh, it's not too bad. It's just over 200, so it's doable. It's
doable.
Very doable.
Okay.
Yeah,
not another heavy text.
My son, who's 14, read it. I mean, he—I don't know, willingly, but he read it. So
that's
manageable.
A good size. It's not daunting, but it sounds like it's an enjoyable read, and I would imagine it's available. I know it's on Amazon. I would imagine it's available. Is it through Kindle as well, and all their media
yeah,
styles?
Yeah, absolutely. Wherever fine books are sold, my publisher tells me.
Okay. I am going out of town, and I'm going to pick it up but electronically and read it, and I look forward to it. It sounds like you have a fantastic and fascinating background, and I really applaud what you're doing with the young people at DePaul University, and with all of that, taking the initiative to bat 250 and go after all of these entrepreneurs out there, and that's got to be one step out of your comfort zone to get out there and do that. But I'm sure once you started getting some wins there, it was very energizing for you. And the name of the book, again, is The Million Dollar Greeting, and it's on Amazon, and it's by Daniel Sachs. Daniel, thank you so much for joining me today. It's really been a fascinating interview, and I look forward to following up with you at some point and see how things are going and hear about the next book. I'm sure there'll be another one after this one.
That's
right?
Great. Yep. Thanks a ton. It was a fun talk. I'm glad we connected.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you coming on. And again, as I say, let's keep in touch, and continued success to you, my friend.
Absolutely. You too. Thanks so much.
All right. All right. We're going to continue on here. Thank you so much for joining us today. If you're just joining us, my next guest is Craig James. And Craig is a Vistage Worldwide chair. And he's going to join us. We're going to have an interesting talk now. Now, if you don't know, if you're a business owner and you're looking to get an advantage and maximize the value of your business, that's what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about the power of peer advantage in maximizing your business value through a group called Vistage Worldwide. So Craig is what's called a chair, and a chair leads groups of business owners through a fascinating experience. We're going to leave the rest up to him. Craig, thanks so much for joining me today, and welcome to the show.
Phil, happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, absolutely. My pleasure. I've been looking forward to this interview, and we have a lot of ground to cover, so I guess let's get right into it. Craig, why don't we start off, if you would, let our listeners know a little bit about you and your background, and tell us what a chair does at Vistage.
Sure. So I was born and raised in outside of New York City and currently live in Boston. For those of you who are familiar with the region, you'll know that that's a pretty toxic mix from at least a sports perspective. I spent 10 years in financial technology sales and sales management. I had founded a sales performance improvement business, which included training, coaching, outsourced sales management, and what I dubbed a sales roundtable. As an alumnus of the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania, I've been a member of the Boston Alumni Club's board for over 10 years and had founded and continue to facilitate a monthly breakfast meeting that I dubbed the Business Exchange, where we discuss and debate current business trends, we bring in speakers, we share events that are of interest in town, mm-hmm. we exchange leads and make business introductions. And it was that experience, Bill, that led me to join Vistage 5 years ago. So as you mentioned, I am currently a chair of two Vistage peer advisory groups. One is for owners, CEOs, and company presidents of businesses under about $10 million in revenue and fewer than 60 employees, and another group that is for professional service providers. So these are the folks who serve the broader community of small to medium-sized businesses, which comprise Vistage's market, which is up to $250,000 in annual sales and hundreds of mm-hmm. employees. And the role of a chair is really to bring the group together, facilitate the group, make sure everybody in the group is having enough airtime, that we're getting deep into issues. As I'll talk about later in our conversation, I also provide one-on-one coaching to members between group mm-hmm. meetings. I've also been a member of the Exit Planning Exchange and was a board member for 3 years for the New England chapter.
Great. Great. Well, you're in the right place. I've got the right guest on the line here. I've been fascinated by Vistage also for many years, and I've been a member for many years. And I know from the statistics I've heard, there's about 22,000 CEOs that belong to this immense group. But an individual group, like you're talking about, that you chair, consists of about how many CEOs?
So an individual group typically has about 12 to 16 CEOs in it. We have determined mm-hmm. over the 60-plus years that Vistage has been around that this is the optimal number. Any fewer than that, there aren't enough brains, as it were, perspectives.
Mm-hmm.
But once you get beyond 16, 18, 20, it becomes a bit of a mob, and you can imagine that many type A personalities in a room, a little bit difficult for people to get airtime and be effective.
Makes sense. So fill us in. What are some of the key attributes of a Vistage meeting? What are the rules of the road, if you will?
Sure. So the key attributes of a meeting, first of all, just to back up, we're very selective with who we invite to join these groups. Not everybody is a good fit for Vistage. We look for people who are lifelong learners. They're looking to continuously improve themselves as leaders, grow their business. They're not content with the status quo. Once we have that group pulled together, the meeting follows a fairly standard format where we come in. It's a monthly meeting, so we come in, we have a little kind of breaking the ice, get to know one another, have a little breakfast, and then we have a process that we call a check-in, which each member will kind of give a quick little update on a numerical scale of 1 to 10. How's their business going? How are they doing personally? And how is their how are they doing health-wise? And they'll also jot down a particular issue that they're wrestling with or might want to run by the group. The reason we do that is we've been apart for about a month, and things have happened in that month. We want to come together, and it's a nice way to get the meeting off to a good start. Once we go through that, there's typically a host presentation where whoever the member is who is hosting that particular meeting will give a little update on his or her business, 30 to 45 minutes. It gives us an opportunity to learn that member's business in greater detail, or if it's an existing member who's been there for a while, to kind of get some updates on where the business is today. And from that, we go into the meat and potatoes of the meeting, which is a process that we call issue and opportunity processing. And it's where a member brings a particularly challenging issue he or she is facing, or a decision of big consequence, which if he gets it wrong, there can be significant ramifications, negative ramifications, both financially, personnel-wise, image-wise. And so they want to get the group's input and feedback, have that decision stress-tested, or just get some clarity on an issue that just might not be clear to them. And we have a process, which is a very Socratic process, where we ask a lot of questions and peel the onion before we start tossing out recommendations, which, unfortunately, is where many CEOs default to. It's their nature to solve problems. The final step
right.
of that is we make the we have a list of recommendations and suggestions that are provided by the members. The member who's brought the issue or decision is then required to pick one or two of those recommendations and commit to taking action on it. We call it an action promise, and by a specific due date. We do that because we need to make sure that this doesn't fall off the CEO's member's plate once he or she leaves the meeting. So there's a level of accountability that makes all the time we've invested in working that issue pay off.
Perfect. You explained that perfectly, and I could picture each of those steps from the many Vistage meetings that I've been in as you went through it. That's exactly how it happens. That's the formula, and there are some other attributes, and one of the key ones is the confidentiality of all of this, that everybody's sworn to secrecy, that this does not leave this room. And most business owners are kind of lonely in that way. They don't have many people to talk to, right, Craig?
Well, that's very true. If you think about it, where can a CEO or business owner go and feel comfortable letting his or her hair down, bearing his soul, being vulnerable without fear of being judged or feeling embarrassed? There aren't too many places that I know of. But in a business group, a peer group, that's not only acceptable, it's expected. It's the one place that they can go to let it all hang out without fear of being ridiculed or embarrassed or judged. Absolutely.
Yeah, and it allows for the discussion of things that might otherwise be very private topics, like you mentioned exit planning. I found that that's a very private topic. Nobody wants to say, hey, I'm thinking about when I'm going to get out of my business or what my plan's going to be. They sure don't want to go to a public seminar on that. They might run into a competitor and a rumor gets started, right?
Right. They certainly don't want to be discussing it with anybody in-house.
Right. So we talk about this power of peer advantage, I've heard you say, and it's a peer advisory group. It's also, I guess, called a private advisory board. How does participating in one of these help a business owner become a better leader and make better decisions, in your opinion?
Sure. So let me take one step back in terms of how this also contributes to a higher valuation of a business. Any M&A professional, mergers and acquisition professional, will tell you quite properly that there are a host of drivers that determine the market value of a business when it's about to be sold. There are internal drivers, such as the accuracy and cleanliness of your books, the degree of customer concentration, the depth of the management team, written HR policies, and so on. And there are external drivers. There's industry and macroeconomic trends. There's competition, barriers to entry, the regulatory environment in which you operate. These are the observable organizational drivers of value. The increase in enterprise value provided by participation in a peer group, Bill, is in the development of the member CEO's leadership skills and the improvement in his or her decision-making skills. Let me explain what that means. Very few of us who have run companies learned how to be a great leader in college. There weren't very many leadership courses. Very few of us went to leadership school. They become better leaders in a peer group in part by learning best practices and behaviors from others around the table, which they then bring back to and implement in their businesses. And the impact of that better leadership is company-wide. It's more engaged and productive employees. It's raving customers. It's greater profits, as well as community-wide, more employment in the community and better wages. And because the decisions they're making on big impact issues and opportunities are being stress-tested and vetted by smart, experienced, and unbiased, that's important, peers who over time get to know each other and their businesses inside and out, the decisions they make are safer, they're less risky, they're made with greater confidence and conviction, and therefore, more often than not, they turn out to be correct. And this
Excellent.
Is borne out, Bill, empirically, year after year in surveys done by Dun & Bradstreet, which compares the 5-year compound annual growth rate of small to mid-sized businesses whose CEOs are members of Vistage Groups with those who are not. And in the latest survey, which was conducted in 2017, the research showed that companies led by CEOs who are Vistage members outperform companies led by CEOs who are not by a factor of 2.2.
That's you know, the other thing about that research is that Vistage is becoming a tremendous source of business research because members are more likely to participate in the surveys, and they're gathering some incredible data, I've been noticing over the last few years. Now, Craig, we're both have drunk the Kool-Aid, right? We both like Vistage, but for someone else out there, they might be saying, you know, I've heard of other groups. There are lots of groups out there that are springing up. It seems like I can think of 3 or 4 of them off the top of my head, at least, that say, well, we're like Vistage, but maybe we don't cost as much, or maybe we don't have full day meetings. But the Vistage formula works for a reason. What is the reason?
That's a great question, Bill, and I think there are a number of reasons. I'm just going to focus on two right now, and they're both somewhat related. Number one, I alluded to earlier in my introduction, is that these groups are formed, facilitated, and led by a trained professional chairperson. We refer to them, as you know, as a chair, who is a seasoned business executive. He's got the battle scars to prove it, and he can relate to the members themselves. And that's important because in other types of situations where you don't have a professionally trained and continually educated, because there is continuing workshops and such, it's a skill like anything else. And the quality of that meeting and really digging through the issues and keeping people on track doesn't happen by magic. It happens because you have a trained person leading the group. Secondly, that chair provides individualized one-to-one coaching to each member in addition to the group meetings. Why is that important? Well, again, many times a CEO or a business owner, they've got people coming to them left and right complaining, customers, employees, investors. They all want a piece of that owner or CEO. This is the one time a month where the CEO gets to sit down and get stuff off his or her chest. So it's a great opportunity for them to talk about what's on their mind that day. Sometimes we'll work on some very specific things like KPIs or strategic planning. But very few other organizations out there do offer that one-to-one coaching, which supplements and complements the group meeting.
That's very important. So it's all of the components. And they also have these, I know there's one coming up in my area here in Southern California. There are several across the country where they're large forum type of events that have fantastic speakers and breakouts and other chances to see and commune with other like-minded business owners. So they have a tremendous resource in that area as well, right?
Yes, we have. These are referred to as the executive summits, where we bring together all the members in a community, for example, Orange County, where you are, or Boston, where I am, for a day of learning, day of socializing, and a day of networking. In addition to that, Vistage has, about a year or so ago, launched another program which we call Vistage Networks. Think of these as affinity groups. So we have a manufacturing network. We have a deal network. We have a wine network, a golf network. And this brings together, again, members both in a community as well as nationwide who have similar interests to collaborate, get to know one another, and support each other both from a business perspective and, frankly, from a personal perspective.
Yeah, and I find those to be very valuable, especially there, as you mentioned, several. There's a family business network which deals with those issues. There's just a ton of great resources there. So you know, this all sounds great, but I'm sure some CEOs just decline to join groups. They're, by nature, they're loners, they're lone rangers. So what do you think are some of the reasons that business owners would not join a Vistage group? What do you think holds them back?
Well, you're right. To some degree, it's the personality. And again, a peer group, whether it's Vistage's or anybody else's, is not for everybody. So part of our vetting process is to make sure that we're attracting and working with the right people. The most common objection or pushback we get is time. Right? I don't have the time for this. I'm too busy. I'm going in 6 million directions. I don't have time to go to lunch. And you're asking me to spend, in my case, 4 hours because I've got a small business group, but in many cases, most cases, a full day. And it's a valid concern, but when you take that concern and you put it back on the prospective member, and this is something that we do in our groups, and have them really think about what they're saying. Well, how do you spend your time? And you literally have them tell you how they spend their time. And in, I would say, 75% of the cases, the one thing that you don't hear them say is time to think, time to reflect, time to innovate.
Mm-hmm.
Which, quite frankly, is a core responsibility of any CEO. So taking a day away from the office, away from the distractions, away from the fire drills, to work on your business, to think, to test your decisions. Okay? If you aren't willing to invest a day, I would suggest that you're doing your company a disservice. And that argument will fly with some folks and it won't with others. And with the ones that it does, we generally have them join. The one that it doesn't, they go their merry way.
Yeah, for a lot of people, that's one of their first issues is I must be doing this wrong because I don't have time to turn around and, you know, it's maybe that's an issue that they would want to process right out of the gate is,
exactly.
What am
what
I doing?
Find, yeah, well,
right?
What we find is that by virtue of participating in these groups, mm-hmm. members learn techniques, they learn strategies for gaining back time, not putting out fires all the time, delegating more when possible, running a smoother operation so that they can create time, as it were, to work on the big picture, to work on strategy, to meet with important customers, things, again, that CEOs really ought to be doing instead of sitting there and responding to 57 emails an hour.
So, Craig, how can a CEO who's intrigued by this idea get a more tangible feel for it?
Well, the most direct way is to connect with a local chair in your community and attend a meeting. There is a process that we have by, which precedes that. As I said, you know, these are very confidential environments. And so what we try to avoid, try very diligently to avoid, is a merry-go-round where people come in and out, trying it out, as it were, and some stay and some don't. So there is a process that we have where, you know, a member would connect with a local chair. Those two would have a conversation if there's enough meat on the bone, as it were. Typically, they would either with another member of the group so that the chair can get a different perspective. Prospective member can get a member's take on the chair and the group dynamic. And at that point, if all things are go, the potential member would be invited to attend and participate in. This is not a come and watch situation. Come and participate in the group meeting.
Right. And, you know, that's a really good point. Vistage is not for everyone, and not everyone gets into Vistage. And it's very important that there's a process so that, for instance, that a competitor of a member doesn't show up and make it awkward for the member. There's a lot of thought and process and quality behind this organization, and part of that quality is having someone like Craig James as your chair. You put a lot of thought into everything you do, and I can tell that by how we prepared for this interview, Craig. I really appreciate you coming on and sharing all the great attributes. How can our listeners get in touch with you if they'd like to talk with you directly about perhaps joining one of your groups?
Well, I'll give you my contact information, and for most of your listeners who will probably not be in the Boston area, feel free to contact me, and I can put you in touch with a local chair in your community. But my phone number is area code 781-269-5690, and my email address is james@vistagechair, V-I-S-T-A-G-E, share.com. And one more thing I would just like to plug before we wrap up here, Bill. There is a wonderful book that I'd like your members to consider getting. It's called The Power of Peers, and it was co-authored by a former CEO of Vistage and a gentleman named Leo Bottery, How the Company You Keep Drives Leaders, Growth, and Success. And it goes into more detail than we could in our 20 minutes here as to what these groups are all about, how they work, what makes them tick. So it's a pretty quick read and a valuable one, in my opinion.
Well, you've certainly given us a lot to think about and some great information on the power of peers, Craig. And thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a real pleasure to talk with you, and I look forward to following up with you and talking again and seeing how everything's going maybe in a few months.
Okay. Well, it was my pleasure as well, Bill.
All right, we're going to roll on. My next guest, thank you so much for joining us again today. If you're just joining us, my next guest is a friend of mine, Jerry Neitlich, from In-House Corporate Real Estate here in Southern California. And In-House Corporate Real Estate provides a unique service to its tenant clients. And we're going to learn about some interesting angles that you might not have thought about with regards to real estate from Jerry. So, Jerry, thanks so much for joining me today. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. I've been looking forward to it. I really appreciate it.
Ah, my pleasure. I've been looking forward to it, too. We've talked about some interesting angles. Now, we see each other in and around early mornings at a group called Provisors, which is a heavily networked group of advisors here in Southern California and other parts of the country. And that makes Jerry a very good resource for all things real estate and in many, many other areas. So, Jerry, tell us a little bit about you and your background before we get into our discussion.
Sure. Thank you, Bill. I really appreciate the opportunity. I actually came to California about 30 years ago, and an opportunity came around to get into commercial real estate, but I was always looking for something that was a little bit unique. I've always been a person who kind of, as they might say, think out of the box. And a friend of mine who I grew up with back in Stamford, Connecticut, was out here. He's a real estate attorney, and he suggested I call a company. At that time, it was a division of Marcus & Millichap. It was called Charter Commercial. And they had a unique approach to commercial real estate. Their approach was to be kind of the outsource for in-house real estate departments. So I met with them. I fell in love with their procedure, their process. I met a gentleman named Dwight Shelton, who had been the head of IBM Real Estate here on the West Coast, and this was kind of his, if you want to call it, his retirement job. And I sat down with Dwight, and he gave me the real full IBM theory of handling real estate. And I took that, and I looked at the market, and I said, well, what is it in the market that there's a need for? And I found that most companies were actually small businesses that really didn't have an in-house real estate department. So I felt that that was a market I wanted to target. I spent 5 years with Marcus & Millichap, corporate real estate division, and then I opened up in-house almost 25 years ago. So I guess it took me 25 years to become an overnight success. So
where
that's
does
where
the
we
time
are
go?
Now. I know, it goes by quickly.
Now, so now you represent tenants, right?
Exclusively, yes.
Exclusively tenants. So now, if you're listening to this and you're a business owner, you probably either own a building or you're a tenant in a building, and you may need some expert advice at some point. What do you find, Jerry, that the most common things you find when you first start working with new clients? What are the situations you see and the first questions that they tend to ask?
Yeah, that's a great question. To start, there was actually a study done back in, I think, 1999 by two psychologists, Dunning and Kruger. They actually, I think, won a Nobel Prize for their study. And the basic premise was that people don't know what they don't know. And 100% of my business comes from referrals. I've never made a cold call in the 30 years I've been in business. So to answer your question, people that refer to me understand that real estate is not their forte. They need someone not to just find them space every 3 to 5 years, but they're looking for a trusted advisor, someone who will help them with the real estate before, during, and in particular after they move into their space. So this way they could focus on their core business while they have an expert who's going to handle all the real estate matters that come up. So that in itself saves them time, money, and headaches. So that's probably the most common thing that I find is if it's someone who's just looking for space, they say, hey, I get these calls all the time. We'll probably talk later on this where someone calls and says, my lease is up in X number of months. I need 10,000 square feet. Could you show me what you have tomorrow? Those aren't my clients. My clients are the ones who understand, just as you would use an attorney as an outside counsel or an accountant, who handles your real estate? And most of the time, it's done by, maybe an administrator or the CFO or someone who handles all their contracts, but not someone who does real estate. And this was actually confirmed in a study we did back in 1993 with UCI on how companies manage their real estate, and that's exactly what we found out. And that's what I find most common, that people are looking for help, but they don't know where to ask. They don't know what they don't know.
Yeah, I would imagine that their questions will come up, like you say. And one of the things that we talked about, Jerry, that's a trend that you see, is that business owners that are aging and thinking about maybe retiring, or I call it rewiring, in the next 3 to 5 years, had better take a look and see what their lease provisions are, because if their lease is coming up in 2 and they want to be out in 3, they may not be able to renew for just a year. They better get ahead of that curve, right?
Exactly. I face that. In fact, I've got a client right now that we wanted to extend our lease for about another year because he was going to retire, decide not to retire. So the landlord just wouldn't accommodate him because there were some back issues why the landlord couldn't. It wasn't necessarily the agent himself or the property owner. I think it had to do with their lender. But they're relocating at the end of the month. We found a property that would do a one-year deal with a one-year option. So even if he decide, well, maybe I'll stay for another year. So that is really critical. You're in a contract. It's a 3 or 5 or 10 year contract that you just can't walk away from. So Bill, you hit the nail on the head. Planning in real estate, and again, we'll talk about it later too. Planning, most critical with real estate.
I can't think of another time when we've had such an aging population that's thinking about, I hear commonly, 3 to 5 years, I want to be out of my business, and a tight market where landlords really have have it sewn up, basically. It's not like like it used to be where you could say, hey, can I just go month to month for a while? They're anxious to get that property released at a higher rate because they can. What are some of the legal trends that you're seeing in commercial real estate now?
Well, there's actually a couple of things. One is the legal issues, and it also goes along with some greater consumer awareness. So there's two really parts to it. First of all, back in 1954, so we're really going back here, back in the days of Willie Mays and the Polo Grounds, but for you baseball fans. But in 1954, the courts actually took a position that commercial real estate was held by sophisticated people who had sophisticated advisors, and that a lot of the laws really should only refer to residential. But it took till really 2014 where the state legislature finally realized that, hey, wait a second, as I said earlier, most of the transactions in commercial real estate are handled by small businesses who don't have that sophistication. So that they passed a law, SB 1171, which required commercial brokers to do the same thing that residential agents have done since 1996, I believe, which was to sign a written document that states whether or not the broker, the agent, is representing a landlord, seller, or a buyer, tenant, or if they're a dual agent. So this has made consumers a lot more aware of the fact that you can get someone to just represent you or someone who's going to represent the landlord and maybe you. So that's been a real big shift in the market the last 3 or 4 years.
So there are no conflicts, or you have to disclose conflicts, is what you're saying. Is it has to be, but the point is, it has to be presented to the person that you're representing, so that they're aware of it. Is that right?
Exactly. That right? In fact, there's been a lot of confusion, and I've been working with the commissioner's office on this. I actually wrote an article, which I believe may appear in the next bulletin. Probably under another name, because they can't use me because I'm an agent. But I basically wanted to outline exactly how the process goes, and there's been a lot of confusion on it. Unfortunately, even in residential, I was on the phone yesterday with the California Association of Realtors. And by the way, Bill, if you don't mind me saying this, a lot of people will refer to me as a realtor. I am not. I'm not a member of the National Association of Realtors. Most commercial brokers are referred to as brokers. We're not. Most California commercial agents are not members of that association. But I was speaking with them just about the process. And even though if you own a house in that stack of escrow forms, you probably have seen, it's like 90 pages and you just sign without even reading it, and they say, oh, it's
right.
Standard form. You got it right. Well, in that pile is a 2079 form, which is the disclosure. You actually are supposed to give that form to the prospective tenant or buyer as soon as you meet them. It says first line, as soon as you meet them, you hand it to them. You then have to present the form when you present an offer or a letter of intent. And then in the document, you have to actually document that and say XYZ broker represents the landlord, XYZ broker represents the tenant. Unfortunately, that form doesn't get disclosed until the actual document, which is way after the transaction has occurred. So that's kind of what the legal thing is trying to push, and there's been a movement on that. So, and the CIR now is aware of that as well.
I see. So, Jerry, when we hear about terms like market knowledge and how important that is, what's your take on that? How important is market knowledge as a tenant broker?
Well, I think I take a different approach. Market information is valuable. There's no question about that. But I think what's most important is understanding your client, because my approach is kind of backwards to a lot of people. I take my client to the market rather than the market to the client. A lot of the traditional in brokerage, commercial brokerage, has been that a broker represents landlords in a certain area, a certain type of product. They try to cold call and say, hey, move to my building, et cetera, et cetera. My approach is, once I understand what the client needs, could be the size, could be the location, could be what the amenities, also what their growth patterns are, once we figure out all of that, we then go to the market. And right now, it's not like 1947 where we had to go. I'm not that old, but back in the day where we actually had to go door to door to find out when the leases were coming up and when they were available. And that was what the listing brokers had, all that knowledge. Now we just click on the internet, and we all have proprietary databases that we purchase, and we have that information. And if it's out there, it's going to be on that database. So I could click a parameter and say, okay, I want everything available, let's say in the spectrum here in Irvine, 1,000 to 5,000 square feet with these and these and these type of amenities, click, and every available property shows up. And the broker's name, so I could call them and say, hey, what is really available? So I think market knowledge is becoming not the thing to push. It's like, how can I help the tenant, or how can I help, in my case, my tenant client, to get to the space that they need? And Mr. Market, come to me and say, okay, I have the property. It's going to be perfect for you. So we end up negotiating usually with three properties, three of the perfect properties, if you want to call it that. So any one of the three could work for my client.
So are there any questions that you ask tenants now that you didn't ask 20, 25 years ago, Jerry?
Well, that's a good question. I haven't thought of that, but I don't think so. I think I've been pretty consistent. As I said, remember I mentioned earlier the great program that Dwight introduced me to. We really have a lot of the same questions. I actually have a questionnaire that I give to larger tenants that they will give to their staff, and it has all these things about what they like and don't like about their existing property. And one of the, actually a funny story is I did it to, it was an architectural firm, and they were located down in Newport Harbor in an old boathouse. And we asked everybody from the senior staff all the way down, what do you think? And they filled out the form. And when we did, it was kind of like before Monkey Survey came out, so we had to sort it one by one. And we found that everybody wanted to stay. The senior staff wanted to stay because they all lived there. Well, the staff want to stay because where are they going to eat lunch? On the beach. So the bottom line was they ended up staying, and they made sure that everybody only had an hour for lunch. So that was kind of a side thing with it.
And you got to empty the sand out of your shoes before you come back in the office.
Exactly.
So, Jerry, it's a great service that you provide. What could you tell our listeners in the way of like tips, ideas, or precautions that maybe some common things that you see that you maybe they should be looking at and thinking about whether they need to call someone like you?
Well, the first thing is, as I said earlier, right on, you got to make sure that you're the person who represents you. No one has the basic knowledge, obviously, but again, you want to really separate between whether they're a tenant rep or whether they're a landlord rep or whether they're going to act as a dual agent. That's really critical because actually something that just came up a couple of months ago, one of the large firms, listing houses, if you want to call it, just bought a tenant rep firm out of Dallas. And one of the things they found was that even though they were getting people who said, okay, today I'll represent the tenant, the skill set of representing the tenant is much different than the skill set representing the landlord. I can't market a building. I wouldn't even know how to market a building. If a client of mine says, hey, I want to either sublet or I want to sell my building, I would refer it out to someone who has that knowledge. And that's something they tell us in real estate over and over again. Don't take anything on that you don't know how to do. They're very persistent about that. So very particular, I should say. So that's the first thing. Make sure that your broker represents you and they really have not necessarily the market knowledge but the skills of what you need. The second tip that I would say is planning. When I get that call I mentioned earlier, and I had this happen once, a guy really called me and said, hey, my lease is up. I need 10,000 square feet. What could you show me tomorrow? Well, I didn't know anything about the client, and I had to ask a lot of questions before we found out what they really, really needed, and it was totally different than what they initially planned or what they initially thought. And the third thing is probably maybe as critical as timing. When I get that call again, my lease is up in 2 months. Can you help me? I'm like, well, let's try and renew because it's not going to happen. It minimum, even if you're a small tenant, it probably takes minimum from the day I start talking to them to the day the lease is assigned, 90 to 120 days. minimum. You have to do tenant improvements, especially for, in fact, we did a full floor a couple of years ago that I think we started about 18 months out, and we started construction about 9 months out. So we had actually done all the planning and everything way prior, and then we still had time to do the improvements, and you know, the tenant moved in actually to the day. It was just perfect. They moved in the day that they were supposed to. So don't let it fester for too long. If your lease is up, hopefully your broker's going to call you, or you're going to be, in my case, we're always in touch with our clients on a constant basis. So we're always reminding them of things that are coming up or what they need to be, pay attention to. So it's really critical. So those are probably the three things. Make sure your broker represents you exclusively and never represents a landlord. Number, make sure that they have the knowledge and skill that you're looking for. Make sure that you're doing a lot of planning beforehand. And then third thing, is the timing of when you start the process.
Jerry, we covered a lot of ground today, and it's really great information, and I think our listeners really appreciate what you've come up with. But there's even more on your website. I noticed you have a monthly blog called Tenant Tactics and Tenant University. To help people that maybe aren't conversant in real estate technology or terminology, rather, and there's information for them about commercial real estate, and they can search by topic. Okay with you if I give out your website address?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, here I go. It's www.inhousecorp.com. Did I get that right?
Yeah, one word, inhousecorp.com, and then .com. Yeah. That's great. Yeah, actually, I'd say the funny story is that the Tenant Tactics, I started that back in 1993 as a mailer, and then it became a fax, and then it became an email, and then it became what we call the blog. So I've gone through it all. But it's
what do you think we'll call it in 5 years from now? Who knows, right?
maybe retirement.
Got to be better than blog.
that's true. But I hope that information is on the blog, but especially the Tenant University, which is on my website. If you're looking for something like occupancy costs or expenses, operating expenses, that's a big one that I get hits on all the time. Just type it in; it'll show you different stories that I posted, and that's 25 years worth of stories right there.
Well, for our listeners, I hope you've enjoyed getting to know Jerry Nightlich. Great information, Jerry, and I'm sure we can have you back at some other time and dig deeper into some of these topics. I thank you for joining me, and I look forward to the next time we get to speak.
It's been my pleasure. Looking forward to it. Thanks, Bill. Thank you very much.
All right. My next guest is with us and ready to go, and I want to thank you for joining me today. It's always a pleasure to have you with us. My next guest is Michael Karoff from Karoff Communications in San Diego, California. And we're going to talk about websites and websites and SEO that rock. And we're going to talk about SEO versus PPC, differences, similarities, and how they all work together. Michael, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you, Bill. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Pleasure to have you with me. And again, as I mentioned in some of our prior guests, I see Michael a lot in and about, early in the morning usually, at a group called Provisors, where we both are out meeting other advisors and getting to know how we can help our clients through those advisors. And Michael, you attend. I see you all over the place. So you're an early morning driver, I guess.
I am a morning person, so it's not too difficult.
All right. And, before we get into the meat of the matter here, SEO versus PPC, tell us a little bit about you and your background.
Sure. As you may know from looking at my site, I'm a reformed musician. By my early 20s, I had achieved my childhood goal of playing music for a living and quickly realized it was a lousy life. So I got a real job, and the job I got might be the most boring job any human can do, and that is editing insurance law books.
Wow.
So when I wasn't trying not to fall asleep, I did learn a lot about typesetting and fonts and page layout, so that when I went to work later for Fender Guitars and talked them into letting me start a magazine, I was kind of prepared. And I did that for eight years. And that was
wow.
a terrific job. I had a lot of fun doing it. And it was while I was doing that that I happened to get a lucky break and start my website business.
That's great. I didn't know that about you. That's an interesting topic. And Fender did not have anything going before that, and you proposed that idea to them, and they said yes?
Yeah, all they had was this kind of cheesy little four-page newsletter. And it took me a while, but I did talk them into letting me start the magazine.
That's fantastic. And so from there, how did you get into this business?
I was starting to hire local people in the music industry to write articles for the magazine after a while. And one of them was coming in for his photo shoot, mentioned the web. One thing led to another. I ended up signing on with him to not only build the first site I'd ever built in 1995, but to try to bring in new customers, and that's what got me started in the marketing end. So I really started building websites, doing SEO simultaneously.
Well, nothing like the voice of experience. I would imagine SEO and website building was a very different looking task than it is now.
Very, very much so. You're right. To tell you how simple websites
there.
Were. Yeah, I mean, I knew page layout from doing the magazine, but I learned HTML coding, which is how you originally built websites, in an afternoon with an online tutorial. That's all it took.
That's amazing.
Now the people that work for me know a lot more than I do, and I can't really keep up.
So now, of course, the internet is a part of everybody's daily life, and a lot of businesses are trying to figure out what's the best way to get exposure and get clients from that. And so we look at all these different techniques out there. And so let's talk about the methods that we've outlined here, SEO versus PPC, which I assume is pay-per-click.
That's correct, yes.
Boy, I'm glad I got that right, because that could have gone really bad right there. Okay, so let's talk about the differences, the similarities, and how they all work together. You want to give us the broad brush outline of that?
Absolutely. I mean, both of them work on the principle of searching. It's the customers or potential customers actually looking for what they want to find, and hopefully it's you. So that's where they come together. But where they're different is, SEO, or search engine optimization, is a slow, very slow build with not a whole lot of control on your side. I equate it to PR, where you have a PR person pitching stories for you, and if you get picked up by a magazine, great, but you can't control it. Pay-per-click, on the other hand, is more akin to advertising. You have a lot of control. You have very specific things that you can do with it, and you can do them very quickly. Now, one of the disadvantages is, with pay-per-click, besides paying someone like me to manage it skillfully, you have to also pay Google for every click you receive.
Right. And I think people might wonder, well, how do I know? What if I get overrun with clicks? I guess that's a good thing, but what if they're not turning into business? What are some of the decision points that you walk people through when they're trying to decide what's the best combination of programs?
Bill, you really hit on the nub of the matter, which is it's very easy to get a ton of clicks or visits to your site. In fact, the staffers at Google are happy to help you do that. But the trick is to get the combination of research, of writing the right kinds of ads, of having ways to filter out people that aren't potential customers, and then converting them once they get to your site. So it's more about quality than quantity.
I gotcha. And so on my line, at least, it cut out right when you said the trick is to get, I think you said, the right kind of customers. Is that what you said?
The right kind of visitors to your website.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
And how does one go about, that's where you come in, I would imagine, to help people figure out, well, who is your, is a start with the end in mind, who is your ideal target? You know, things have changed a lot as far as being able to target to those specific individuals. I don't think people realize how much targeting is available from all the information that's been gathered. Can you address that?
Absolutely. Now, one of the misunderstandings is people think we can target, like, let's say that you want to reach, you sell pharmaceuticals and you want to reach doctors, and they come to us and say, can you target doctors? We have to say, no, we can't target doctors. What we do is we figure out, if we were a doctor, what would we be looking for online? What would we type in? We start with that, and then as time goes on and we see people coming to the, clicking on the ads and going to the site, we start to filter out the things that aren't working and filter out the things that are working. And a lot of times, it's more about what's working. We can't tell you why. Like, I can't tell you why your ads perform better between 2 and 4 in the afternoon on Tuesday and Thursday. But the important thing is we know that, so we give those more weight. That's where the data comes in.
Okay, so it's figuring out what someone would likely put in to search for your product or services, and then it used to be, I don't know if it's still like this because I know it's always changing. That's one area I want you to address too. That it used to be they just put, let's say you wanted to sell widgets in Newport Beach, you put Newport Beach widgets all over your copy and your website, and it would pick up on that. But I don't think that's true anymore, is it?
No. Now you've sort of switched over to the organic side, or SEO, from pay-per-click. And
okay,
You're right. It's not that simple. Every time people figure out how to, quote, game the system, Google figures it out and doesn't let them do it. So the best advice I can give people is, if you produce really good content, written content or video content, that's relevant to your potential customers and viewers and valuable to them, that is the most powerful tool you can use to get good search engine positions. And there are a number of other auxiliary methods that we use, but good, well-written content was the core 20 years ago and is still the core today.
Well, and not only that, but you create websites that rock, right? So when someone looks at a website, and I've been on some experiments where some people have said, here, tell me your company name, I'll see how searchable you are and I'll see what your website looks like. And some of the websites are just horrible. They compared to what now it seems to be all about big graphics, less clutter on the page, and just kind of leading people through to, you know, what's the most important thing for them to do. Tell us how, you know, when you look at a website, what are some of the things you look at where you say, this really is not a good website, and no wonder, you know, and we can really help you, no wonder you're not getting much business out of this.
Well, probably the worst thing I see on websites is that they don't work well on all devices. Now, it used to be enough that you had a website for a computer and you also had a mobile version. That's no longer sufficient. Your website has to be designed and programmed such that anything I'm using, whether I'm on a tablet, a phablet, phone in portrait or landscape view, a laptop, a huge desktop, any device I'm looking at your website on, it seems to me that the website was designed exactly for that device. And that's the key. It's what we call liquid design. Your website flexes like you had water in a sealed bag and you squeezed it, and the water goes wherever it should go to fill that bag. Your website should work the same way.
So that's a telltale sign, right, that it doesn't conform. How about from a copy design, where people just used to think, well, I'll just put as much up there as I can, and the spaghetti theory, I guess, of designing a website?
I have no problem with putting a lot of material, but we use a philosophy called bite-sized chunks of information. The human mind can only absorb so much at a time, so you separate it out into categories and subcategories and little pieces so that as a viewer, I can process it and go to where I want. And then after that, you can put as much material as you want. You can go as deep as you like.
Okay. So when you're when you're first working with someone, what are some of the questions that you get frequently from someone when they're just starting off with you and they say, you know, can you take a look and tell me what you think? What do you ask and what are they looking for generally?
That's a good point. One of the things that they often come and say is, well, we're not mobile friendly, which is goes back to what I said earlier. And what mm-hmm. they mean is people have told them it doesn't work well on the phone. And that's when I guide them through the process and say, you're right, you need to work well on a phone, but what about tablets? Oh, I never thought about that. Oh, what about your laptop? That looks different than your big screen computer. Oh, I never thought about that. So we also get them to understand that these days, almost everyone looks at a website they're interested in from multiple devices. They may be out standing in line during the day looking at something on their cell phone, and they go back to their office to look at another computer. What you want is for them to get to that site on the other device and go, oh, yeah, this is where I was. This is the same site. Not, are these the same people? I really can't tell.
Right, right, right. Consistency, right?
Yeah.
So you have a particular client success story I think you wanted to share with us today.
Yeah. The one that I think speaks the most relevantly to today's world is it's a nutraceutical company that came to me a couple of years ago and said, well, we have this new brand. We need a website. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I started taking a look at them, and they had five different brands, all of which looked completely different. There was no consistency. So what I advised them to do, and they did, was let me redesign all the sites so that they're compatible, complementary, but also have individual personalities, and that's what we did. And after they saw that work and they saw the marketing work, they asked us for our big idea. And we said, we think you need to have a new brand where you coalesce your vegetarian products or vegan-based products into one line instead of having them spread out. So they let us do that. After we did that, we put out some press releases on it, and it got picked up by some sites that market websites online just, you know, for free to people. Last month, they had 50,000 submissions to their free sample offer. That was a problem in that they didn't have that many samples, but they also captured 50,000 addresses and emails in one month. You can't pay for that kind of thing. I mean, it was unbelievable, and they were very ecstatic.
That is above and beyond their expectations, I'm sure, right? I mean, that's to come in and say, hey, the way I see it, maybe we should combine a few things here, make it easier for consumer to pick up on more of what you do. That's fantastic.
Yeah, well, it's the kind of success as a vendor you know you hope for, but don't always see that level. So it's gratifying when you do.
Now, I'm sure part of this is that bleeds through is your creativity as a musician, you're in an excellent Santana tribute band and play some pretty big venues. How does being in a band make you a better manager of a digital marketing company?
managing the people in the band is harder than managing a company. No, Bill, you're a musician too, so you know. A band is like a giant dysfunctional family. And mm-hmm. if you can keep that together, then it gives you a lot of the skills you need to run a company. You're dealing with venues, you're dealing with the company, you're dealing with clients. You're dealing with band members that often have egos and issues. In your company, you're dealing with your contractors or employees or whatever. So it definitely has helped. I've always been the band leader ever since I was 14, and that's helped me be the person at the helm of the company.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are a lot of moving parts, like you said, personalities and getting equipment to certain places on time and making sure that you're managing your time properly. When you think about it, there are a lot of similarities, and of course that with what you're doing, it allows you to use your creative mind in ways that are much better for people. I mean, when you think about web design, and sometimes you think, well, this person is just going to be a technology kind of a nerd, if you will. But bringing that creative side of it, I'm sure, benefits your clients in many, many ways, and you get thanks for that, I'm sure, Michael. I hear great things about the thank yous that you get from people in and around the group Provisors that we both belong to, and so you do a great job. And you had a couple tips for us, I think. Before we go, tips, ideas, or precautions for our listeners?
Absolutely. So the first thing is, and this especially has to do with SEO and or PPC, pay-per-click. Somebody tells you things, always go in with skepticism. Because honestly, there is no magic bullet. There's no secret method that this one person or company knows. It's basically just a lot of time and hard work and a certain level of skill. So if something sounds too good to be true, it is. I think that's the biggest tip I can give people with SEO. With websites, I'd say find somebody who's got experience to build your site and look at the work they've done before and go on their websites. Visit the sites they've built on a phone, on a tablet, on anything you can find, and make sure that they really do all work. Because while you may not be thinking about that, they should be.
Great, great ideas. And that's a big part of it is understanding the work that you put into understanding your client, as you mentioned with your story, that you can see where they're trying to get to, not just do some technical work on their site, and that's very important. You're a very creative individual, and I've enjoyed getting to know you, and I'm glad you're there for our listeners and our clients. Now, if someone wants to get in touch with you, what's the best way for them to reach out?
At the website, it's www.caroff, which is CAROFF as in frank.com.
Okay. And from there they can see some of the, as you said, some of the samples and things that you've done. Obviously, you would expect to see good websites at your website, I would hope.
You would expect to, and hopefully we have that. Yeah, we actually have several dozen samples of our portfolio, and they're broken up by category. So there's medical, legal, services, products, financial, whatever thing you're looking for, you should be able to find.
So if you're listening to this and you look at your website and you think, you know, maybe it's time that I really stepped it up. There's been, you know, I know my website could be better. Call Michael Caroff. There's nobody better in the world that you can call in this industry. Go to the website, www.caroff.com. Get in touch and improve up your game and see if maybe you can get your website to work as hard as you do for your business. Michael, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a real pleasure, and look forward to seeing you out and about, and I look forward to the next time we speak.
I do as well. Thanks again, Bill.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back after this, so please stay with us.
Hey everybody, it's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. One of the questions I get asked the most is, how do I grow the value of my business? I'm so busy working in it, I need to work on it. So we've created a special report for you on 10 tips to grow the value of your business. Just text the word DRIVERS to 44222 to get a special free report right to your inbox. That's DRIVERS to 44222. Text DRIVERS to 44222.
Thank you for listening to Exit Coach Radio.
Hi, everyone. It's Bill Black, the Exit Coach from the Exit Coach Radio Show. You know, one of the biggest questions I get on the show is, what exactly goes into a business exit plan, and when should I start creating mine? Well, I always tell people that the best time to start was 5 years ago, but the next best time is now, because you never know when you might need it. So we put together a free report that describes what an exit plan is and what you should know. You can get it free by texting exit plan with no spaces to 44222. That's exit plan to 44222. Again, text exit plan to 44222.
Welcome to the Exit Coach Radio Show, the show for baby boomer business owners who are looking for cutting-edge information as they plan their 3 to 10 year business succession and exit. Every week, we interview top professional advisors for their best tips, strategies, and precautions so you can be well-planned. And don't miss our one-minute Exit Coach tip of the day on ExitCoachRadio.com. And now, here's your host, the Exit Coach, Bill Black.